You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
I'm Drew Leiter.
And I'm Cletus Jacobs.
And welcome to episode 337 of the Earth Station DCU! Tonight we're going to talk Danger Street number 6, Superman Lost number 3, Stargirl The Lost Children number 6, Batman White Knight Presents Generation Joker number 1, Green Lantern number 1, and the final episode of The Flash, Season 9, Episode 13, A New World Part 4. But before we get into that, let's talk some DC news. All right, Cletus, first up for DC news. Batman, Catwoman, The Gotham War sees Selina Kyle take on the mantle of crime boss, leading the sometimes allies, sometimes lovers to go to war against each other. The event is written by Chip Zdarsky and Tina Howard and penciled by Mike Hawthorne and Andriano Bendetto. It will open with a special one-shot before continuing into the main Batman and Catwoman solo books, as well as a pair of two-issue miniseries, The Gotham War Red Hood and The Gotham War Scorched Earth. This new Dawn of DC event follows hot on the heels of July and August line-wide Night Terror saga and will pick up directly after Night Terror's Batman No. 2 by Joshua Williamson and Trevor Hairsine.
Well, Josh Williamson is leading into it, you know it's going to be good. I'm assuming that the plan in general is Zdarsky's, considering he's the lead Batman writer. The only question I would have is that we know that clearly, for reasons unknown to us, Williamson is DC's top guy. I can't finish that sentence without laughing, but it's true. So I assume this is Zdarsky's story, but it's possible that it's been outlined by Williamson. I don't really know. I'd be curious to find out because, I mean, Catwoman becoming a crime lord has definitely been where they've been building with this whole "I'm building an empire" that I feel like we read in basically every book now. So that in and of itself is not a shocking development, Drew. But the two of them turning antagonistic towards each other is quite the change, to put it lightly, considering how involved Batman has still been during this entire thing for Catwoman. So, I don't know, man. I am unsure how well... I mean, obviously, it's going to depend on how well-written it is, right? Like, if it's well-written, it's probably going to do well and be well-received. But I don't know, man. I don't know that this is what the Batman audience is looking for. Obviously, I'm trying to separate my own personal bias, which is not wanting a Batman versus Catwoman event. I don't feel like I'm in the minority, Drew. I don't know about you. My general impression of people's opinion is I don't know that they were asking for this, Drew.
Yeah, I'm not asking for it. I don't want to see a Batman versus Catwoman either. So I am more confident that Chip Zdarsky is writing it. But he's probably only writing the Batman part of it. Tini Howard's probably writing the Catwoman part of it. And they're just going to have to go off of what Williamson's done in Night Terrors. Which, originally, I wasn't planning on even doing that event. But if it's going to be tying into a bunch of stuff, we might have to do it just to... And what the heck is going on?
Well, then that's sort of the problem with superhero comics right now, right? Is and this is why they continue to struggle, Drew, is they're going to do this event and they will see increased sales during the event, but they are going to lose other readers who don't want to read that, and then they don't understand what's going on in the book that they are reading. I don't want to get into the, because we've gone into that every, like, almost every month, but, like, this is a perfect example of how that both Marvel and DC are killing their own brands with these events. Like, if you just want to read Batman, Drew, you can't. You have to read that event.
Yeah, unfortunately. My original plan was to skip Night Terrors, but I don't think we're going to be able to, Cletus.
I know. Well, and that's the thing. You and I will still read it, right? Because it's part of what we're doing. It's part of what the podcast is. But for other people who maybe can't add comics to their budget or don't have the desire to, what it's more likely, they're just going to drop back. They're not going to suck it up and fork over to read Night Terrors, right? They're just going to drop Batman. I just don't understand how DC doesn't see that. And it's not just them. Marvel is just as guilty of doing it as DC is. You know, I just don't get it, Drew. Again, going back to the event, I like Zdarsky as a writer. I don't know, man. This is not a premise that appeals to me. So it's going to be a tough sell. I'm not going to lie.
Agreed. All right, well, let's move on to our next bit of DC news. Kelly Thompson announced in a tweet that she will be writing a new Birds of Prey comic for DC. The series will be drawn by Leonardo Romero and colored by Jordi Belair. Further details of the book are sparse, but it was revealed that Black Canary is building the most dangerous Bird of Prey team yet. The book should be releasing in the fall. Now, I'm an old school Birds of Prey fan. My Birds of Prey consist of Barbara Gordon, who was Oracle, just Oracle at the time. You had Black Canary as one team member, and the other one was the Huntress. So that's the Bird of Prey team I'm used to. I know I can feel it. They're going to have some new lineup that I am not going to care for.
I would be shocked if it's the classic lineup, Drew. But if it's good, one of those things, the thing is, though, Drew, like, I don't blame you for having a lineup that you like, because I have the same opinions of other teams. But the key thing is, if it's written well, it won't matter, right? If it's only okay, then your preferences are going to kick in. But that's sort of the thing with a lot of these books, is like, you can take the gamble and do something new to shake it up. And if it's written well, it's going to be great, right? But, you know, I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah, it's going to have to be written well for me to like the new team. Let's just put it that way. So, I mean, if it's written well, I'll like it. But if it's not, it's going to be a tough sell for me. All right, and in other DC news, DC has released the trailer for the R-rated Justice League animated movie, Justice League War World. Justice League War World has a release date of July 25th, so a little over a month away.
I watched the trailer for this, Drew. A surprising takeaway I have from this is that it feels almost like a collection of shorts. I'm sure it's going to be woven together more than what the trailer showed, but it looked like it were, in a sense, getting three different stories kind of being tied in together with the Justice League going to War World, which is not what I was expecting for what this film was going to be. So that was surprising. We'll see. We'll see how it goes. I mean, I'm intrigued by the different plot lines that the trailer shows. You have a, like, golden age, you know, black and white version of Superman, which is interesting. You have, like, it looked like, to me, Drew, a caveman. Definitely very old version of Batman. And then a Wild West version of Wonder Woman. So, potential for some really cool stories there. Why those are all part of a War World story, I guess we'll find out. I'm assuming there's some sort of, feel like maybe it's something Black Mercy related. I don't know. We'll see, Drew. That's really not what I was expecting. I'm glad I watched the trailer, because that is not at all what I thought the movie was going to be. But it could be good. It's not a complaint. I was that trailer really surprised me. I was like, wow, that's not what I thought this movie was.
Yeah, I'm intrigued by it too. Especially Wonder Woman in the Old West with Jonah Hex. That looks interesting. And I think we saw Aquaman somewhere in there too.
I couldn't tell if it was Aquaman or if it was Green Arrow, Drew. I thought, I got, this was off of, again, small clips of the trailer, right? But I was almost under the impression the guy that was with Batman was Ollie.
Okay, maybe I'm wrong or misremembering, because I watched, this was a few days ago.
Well, I don't blame you. It's a guy with long blonde hair and a blonde beard. So it certainly could be Aquaman. But I feel like I saw him using a bow briefly in one clip. I don't know. It's one of the two, right? I don't know which one.
All right. And for our last bit of DC news, author Stephen King has seen DC's upcoming The Flash movie, taking to social media to give his honest review. I got an advanced screening of The Flash today, As a rule, I don't care a lot for superhero movies, but this one is special. It's heartfelt, funny, and eye-popping. I loved it. Now, out of all the famous people we've heard about seeing the movie, Cletus, Stephen King report on it has most intrigued me, just because it wouldn't be something you'd normally hear from him. But I'm also wondering, did he get paid to preview this? That's the thing I keep, all these celebrities have been hearing preview this movie. Are they getting paid to preview this movie? I've been very curious about that.
I can't fathom why you would pay Stephen King, of all people, to watch your movie, Drew, because how persuasive is he going to be? Like, is the thing between you going to see The Flash or not in theaters Stephen King going on Twitter and saying he likes it? I don't know. It's possible that person exists out there, Drew. Enough to be worth paying him? I don't know. Are they giving him a free screening so that the hopes that he likes it and says something positive? Yeah, that's probably true. I don't know, man. I have no insight, but I'd be a little surprised that they paid him. What do you gain out of that?
I don't know. I just, knowing what I know of Stephen King, I wouldn't think he'd want to go see a superhero movie. But, you know, maybe if he was offered it for free, he'd be like, sure.
I think it was, hey, if you're interested, we're doing a screening. Do you want to come see it? And he probably was like, why not? That seems far more plausible to me, Drew. I just can't see it being worth DC's time to pay people, because that's just not going to... What's interesting to me, Drew, while we're on the topic, though, so we keep hearing a lot of positive buzz about this film, and DC keeps screening the crap out of this film, right? Like, they are putting it out there, and they are letting people talk about it, which is a huge change from what DC had been, right? We were getting review embargoes that would go right up until basically the movie came out, most of the time because the movie was bad and they didn't want people to know until the movie was there. But like, that is a huge change in direction for what DC has done in the past, how open they have been, letting people see it, letting reviews get... Drew, the Rotten Tomatoes score is out for this movie. Reviews are out for this movie, and it's out for another week. Reviews have been out for a couple weeks. It's wild to me how open DC has been with this film, which is a huge, huge change in direction for how they've operated, which makes me wonder, are we going to see more like this from DC? Is this a James Gunn / the other guy decision? Or is it just confidence in this film? DC has projected a lot of confidence into this film, which is surprising for a film that is rated as decent. I've not read in detail any reviews. I've just seen like the number ratings that people have given. And it's like a solid B+ from a lot of people, which is good. Like, that's better than what a lot of DC films have been. But the amount of confidence that DC has shown in this film for something that thus far people have said is pretty good is really surprising, Drew.
What surprised me is I went and saw Guardians of the Galaxy today, the trailer for the Flash movie, the week before it comes out. I'm like, usually if a movie's coming out in a week, you're not going to see the preview for it in the movie theater. You know, they're usually done showing it by then. And I was very surprised to see it.
Because the only thing I'd question possibly, Drew, is it because of the movie that you were seeing? That was packed for the theater you were at, that was packaged with Guardians. And Guardians has been out for several weeks.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Depending on the theater, depends on what, you know, trailers you see. But I feel like I don't know, obviously, the inner workings of every theater, but I feel like theaters have a certain trailer package that they put with the movie. And I would be shocked if they changed that trailer package from week to week.
That's true. What I was surprised was when I went and saw the movie today, how many people were actually in the theater. So the theater was probably about half full.
That's not bad. That movie is, what, about a month old at this point?
Yeah. I was surprised there were so many people there. So
we just went and saw the new Spider-Verse film today, and it was packed on a early Sunday after. It was 11 o'clock on a Sunday. It was full.
Wow. That's surprising for Sunday morning.
We always, the theater that we go to, you have to, like, you have, like, assigned seats. So we always get our tickets ahead of time so that we make sure we actually have seats that we want to sit in. And I could have gotten the tickets last night, but I was like, oh, we're going to see it early on a Sunday. It'll be fine. Like, I'm sure people will be there, but it's not going to be that big of a deal. It was close. We almost didn't have seats, so.
Yeah, that's surprising.
Yeah, but it's great. Obviously, great for that movie, and it was good. So, I mean, I can see why, you know, I mean, people want to come see it. But hopefully, we're talking about that with The Flash. We'll see. The positivity that DC and Warner Brothers have projected for this film is a pretty stark contrast when you think about the other films that we've seen come out during the Snyderverse, so to speak, and all these DC films we've seen. It's a pretty notable difference. I'm going to be very, very curious to see how this film does. I've seen at least one or two reviews that the Ezra Miller dilemma directly affected the score, and I wonder how that's going to impact some people's desire to see the film, impact people's opinion of the film. It's just, Drew, I don't think I've ever been so curious to see how a movie is going to do, regardless of the quality of the film. Like, obviously, I want the film to be good, right? But, like, I don't know, man. This is such a unique situation. I don't know that the guy starring in the film is going to have a career after this film. So, it's very interesting.
Yeah. And how the movie ends, I'm sure they can easily replace who's playing the Flash. You know what I mean? Especially with it being a multiverse thing. I'm kind of curious. I've been curious if they've changed the ending to this movie or not. They probably wouldn't tell us, but
yeah, you gotta think that they would. It would be inexplicable not to use Flashpoint, which is what the film is, not to use Flashpoint to set up the new universe. Like, it's DC in some ways has kind of their own incompetence has sort of allowed them to stumble into an easy reset button. I would hope that they would take advantage of that. I'm not expecting anything huge, like a major change to the end, but some sort of nod to, like at the end of Flashpoint, you see the new character designs that would become the new 52, right? Like, it doesn't go, Johns doesn't dive deep into what the new 52 was going to be, but you get a sneak peek of what those characters are going to look like for the next, what was it, like 4 or 5 years? I don't think they've cast Superman. See, that would be the thing. If they had cast Superman, that would be a perfect opportunity for the new one to show up right at the end of the film.
Yeah, it would.
On the other hand, Drew, the problem with having the actor that they have is you'd have to change the actor of the Flash right at the end too.
Yeah, that was my point.
Yeah, I don't know. So I don't know. Drew, I'm so fascinated by what this movie's going to be, how it's going to do, how it's going to be received. I'm just very curious. Like, I'm not even. It's weird, Drew. Like, usually when one of the big DC films is upcoming, I'm usually a mixture of quite excited and also a little nervous that they're going to damage their reputation more than they already have. And usually that ends up being true. But I don't even really care this time. Like, I'm mostly just curious. Like, if this film's a disaster, I don't think it is. It doesn't seem like it is. But if it's a disaster, I don't even really think I'd be upset. I'd be more like, huh. So that's what happened. You know what I mean? Like, I'm mostly just curious at this point.
Even if this movie is a disaster, it doesn't really matter because we're resetting. So that's just how I feel about it right now. I'm going in not expecting much and hoping it's good. And if it ends up being a disaster, I don't really care because we already know we're starting over. It'll be when we get to that first James Gunn movie is when it's going to matter more. So I'm very curious to see how The Flash is going to be. But if it's a disaster, it doesn't really matter to me because I know we're already resetting. So whether it's good or bad doesn't really matter to me that much. That's what I'm trying to say.
Agreed.
All right, well, that wraps up our DC news for this week. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll do our comics talk.
What are people saying about the Best Saturdays of Our Lives podcast?
Yes, what are they saying?
It's a refreshing blend of nostalgia and academia.
I like the animation programming strategy.
I tune in for the amazing celebrity interviews.
An insider's glimpse behind the scenes of your most beloved childhood memories.
What's your website? TheBestSaturdaysOfOurLives.com?
And the amazing ESO Network.
Clank.
Clank.
We got some beer today.
Yeah, beer.
Big boys.
But our podcast isn't about the booze.
It's not just about
clinking
things.
It's not just
things.
About drinking and clinking things.
Oh, you're right. It is about, like, nerdy things
nerd
and comic
stuff.
Books and video games and movies and
nerd stuff.
Yeah.
If you like anything nerdy, grab a drink and be nerdy with us.
Join us.
But first, let's talk nerdy.
And we're back. But before we get into this week's comic books talk, gotta let you know, there's gonna be spoilers.
We got spoilers.
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 We got spoilers.
Spoilers.
For you. We got spoilers.
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 We've got spoilers.
Spoilers.
For you. For you.
All right, let's talk Danger Street number 6. Warlord wakes up handcuffed to a hospital bed. The lady cop is sitting in his recovery room, patiently reading a newspaper. The lady cop tells him that she ran his fingerprints and knows he is Travis Morgan, an AWOL Air Force captain who went missing with an F-22 Raptor a few years back. She wants to know where the Blue Star Man is. Abdul from the Green Team is holed up in a hotel with two armed men standing guard outside. The Manhunter shows up and kills both guards. When the Manhunter enters the room, Abdul is sitting on a chair holding a shotgun. Abdul fires the shotgun, knocking the Manhunter back. The Manhunter is not down for long and grabs the shotgun from Abdul. Abdul runs to the other room and jumps out the window, falling several stories into a pool. The Manhunter looks out the window to see Abdul giving him the bird. Orion tells Highfather and Darkseid that he's located Atlas's soul, but he was met with opposition and apologizes for his failure. Highfather tells Orion of their plan to delay the falling of the sky, but it is up to Orion to save the universe. Crunch returns to the abandoned house with some grapes for the other boys and finds the blue-skinned Starman tied to a chair unconscious. Nonfat tries to wake him up, but it is useless. You can't kill a man before you talk to him. He needs to know what he has done. Abdul calls the Commodore, upset because he can't get money out of the bank. Everything is frozen. He wants to know where their man is that's supposed to be protecting him. Suddenly, Abdul's call disconnects due to non-payment of the bill. Starman wakes up and breaks the ropes holding him captive, while Crunch and Nonfat are arguing in the other room. The lady cop is sitting at her desk talking to the Helmet of Fate when she notices a plate on it that states the Green Team. Abdul is knocking on the door, desperate to be let in. Mary tells Abdul that he hates him for stealing from them. Mary finally relents when Abdul tells her that the Commodore betrayed him and someone is trying to kill him. Mary tells the others that the outsiders are the only people that can save Abdul. The Helmet of Fate tells the reader that all the players have been revealed, but asks if it is too late for a truly happy ever after. To be continued.
Really good issue, Drew. I was surprised Abdul survived the issue, if I'm being honest. I really thought he was dead. And then we got the Outsiders, which was not the Outsiders I was expecting. There was a lot less Katana and Black Lightning.
I noticed that, too. They look more Doom Patrol-ish to me.
That is a perfect description. We also got, I felt like, a pretty ominous line from the Helm of Fate at the end, again, confirming what we already know, right? Which, as usual for these Tom King stories, it's not going to end well. Yeah, I don't know. I feel like this is going to be a complete disaster at the end of this story, Drew.
I agree with you. And I'm very intrigued to see what's going to happen. I have no clue where this story's going.
I don't either, to be clear. I have no idea, but I don't even... This story doesn't feel like it's going to be a sort of bittersweet ending. Like, as we were reading The Human Target, like, they were pretty upfront that The Human Target was probably not going to survive. But you got the feeling that that could be a bittersweet ending, which is what we got. Some heartbreak, but some good, right? I don't know, man. Like, I wouldn't be shocked if this is a brutal ending. It doesn't feel like anything good is going to happen, man. I don't know. Maybe the kids are going to be not the green team, but the other kids are going to be okay. But I don't feel good about any of them. I don't feel good about Orion. I don't feel good about the cop. I don't feel good about the two guys that had the helm. I don't know, man. I feel like a lot of people are going to be dead by the end of the story.
I'm pretty sure High Father and Darksider can survive. I'm not too worried about them.
Maybe. I don't know. They implied if Orion doesn't succeed that everything's going to collapse in on itself, basically. Like, Highfather is essentially holding up the world like what Atlas was supposed to be doing before he got killed by Starman. I don't know. Obviously, I mean, like you said, Drew, I have no clue. I've had any issue of this book, I have had no idea where the story is going, which I like. It's been a fun ride. My gut, though, if I had to bet, I would be betting on an ugly ending.
Yeah, I have to agree with you on that. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week, Superman Lost number 3. Lois is working on her story when she hears a ping. Lois gets angry and knocks everything off the table, including her laptop. Lois yells at Clark, stating she is not his maid. Lois digs in the closet until she finds the broken interface and the solar uniform Superman wore when he was lost in space. Superman wakes up in space to a greeting of good morning from his interface. It has been 213 days since he left the planet he has dubbed Kansas. Superman comes across some space dolphins that Lobo once told him about. Superman asks the telepathic creatures if he can hitch a ride because they travel faster than light. Superman and his suit get recharged when the dolphins take him by a yellow sun. The dolphins finally reach their destination, which is an energy field. The dolphins' calves are stuck inside, kind of like a Venus flytrap. Upon further investigation, Superman discovers the energy field is protecting a planet. Superman reaches out to the intelligent life that allows him to pass through the energy shield. When Superman reaches the planet, he spots a Sandman version of himself that punches him. The Sandman creature is angry at Superman for leading the space dolphins to them. The space dolphins are predators that feed on their species, microscopic organisms that are similar to protozoa. There are trillions or quadrillions of the creatures here. Superman convinces the microscopic organisms to alter their energy shield to deter the space dolphins. The microscopic organisms also tell Superman of invaders known as the Concentratio, who attacked their world with vessels and devastated it. Superman decides to find these invaders because they must have a star drive that could possibly get him home to Earth. Suddenly, the space dolphins leave, taking Superman's survival rig in their wake. Superman chases after them but can't catch up. He wastes his reserve energy. Angry, Superman smashes the interface device.
I didn't dislike the issue. I liked seeing Superman. One thing I liked that he captured, Drew, is that Superman is smart in this, right? Relatively. You know what I mean? Like, he's doing calculations. He's trying to figure stuff out. I like that because I feel like sometimes you get versions of Superman that focus more on his humanity, which is not bad, to be clear. I like that, right? But I like the Grant Morrison, I thought, always did a good job of this, of showing that Superman is super in all aspects, that he's not just super strong, but that he is also very intelligent. And I felt like we got that in this issue, which at least I got that impression. So I liked that. We didn't really progress a whole lot, which I think is, again, sort of the point, because the dude was gone for, what was it, 2 decades? Is that right, Drew?
He was gone for 30 years, I'm pretty sure.
30 years? Okay, so a little more than that. Okay. Yeah, I didn't dislike it. It didn't wow me, but it was pretty good. I do think that the book is struggling with what to do in the present day of the story. I know that the framing device has to be what it is, because that twist of like Superman was gone for 30 years when it was really only like an hour or two. We have to know that for the rest of the context of the story, but like the lowest bit at the beginning didn't really do anything, right? It was basically just to remind you that what you're seeing is a flashback.
Right, and it still bugs me that she's so angry about it. Well, I mean, I can understand if Superman's curling up in a ball on the floor like we've seen him, why she'd be angry about that, but I don't know. It still felt kind of, I don't know, it just felt, her anger feels weird to me.
It is odd, Drew, because I feel like occasionally they've portrayed her as if he really did go missing for 30 years. They didn't. She didn't even know he was gone. Right? He just shows back up. She's like, oh, perfect timing. And he's like, what?
Yeah, because to her, it's the same day. I guess that's one of the reasons why I don't get the anger so much. I mean, I can understand why she'd be angry for the way he's acting, curling up on the ball on the floor or something, but to be angry that he was missing, it was not really missing. Coming back the same day several hours later, that should be normal for her. Because Superman's always zooming away and coming back. So, I don't know. I didn't get it in the first issue, and I didn't get it in this one either. Why is she so angry? Other than that, the rest of the story was fine. It was kind of cool seeing the space dolphins. Though I don't really get how an animal could travel faster than light like that, but whatever. So, it was kind of interesting. And they kind of hinted at what the next story was going to be with these invaders. Because I'm sure we're going to see Superman interact with these invaders soon. Alright, well let's move on to our next issue for this week. Stargirl, The Lost Children, number 6. The Hourman from the future traveled back in time and joined the Justice Society of America when Stargirl did. He was built in the 853rd century using Miraclo-enhanced DNA from the original Hourman, Rex Tyler. Hourman of the future had sacrificed himself to save Rex Tyler and his son, Rick. Now somehow he is back. The Childminder tells Hourman to put Stargirl in stasis. The Childminder wants what she was promised, her youth back. The Childminder tries to use her powder to make Stargirl forget. Stargirl flips away and zaps the Childminder with her staff. Hourman holds out his hand and years are taken from Stargirl as she becomes an old woman. Hourman states that his owner demands payment from Stargirl for what she did to him. Corky and his raccoon friend Crockett attack Hourman. The connection with Stargirl is broken, and before it becomes permanent, her youth is returned. Suddenly, Hourman's master shows up. It's a grown-up Corky Baxter, and he's a Time Master. The grown-up Corky tells Stargirl that the young Corky isn't here to rescue any of these sidekicks. He came back to send Wing from where he was pulled from so that the world isn't destroyed. Grown-up Corky tells Stargirl that these children need to remain outside of our timeline because history is stable and doesn't need any more surprises. He can return both her and Amiko, Queen, to their homes. Stargirl states she is not leaving any of them here, and that includes Hourman. Judy Garrick grabs Hourman's robotic brain while Courtney calls for Cosmo. Quiz Kid and Judy Garrick pull a microchip that is different from the rest of the brain and plug it back into Hourman. Hourman is himself again. Hourman knocks grown-up Corky into a time portal. Young Corky grabs Wing and tries to throw him into a time portal. Stargirl holds out her staff and Wing catches it. Wing tells Stargirl that he must let go. He must die saving the world. Hourman explains that no one is able to return to their own time for a variety of paradoxical reasons. Stargirl brings them all back to her timeline and decides to start a new team. Stargirl and the Young Justice Society return in Justice League of America, number 6.
This book didn't really do it for me, Drew. I'm not going to lie. I mean, it was fine. It wasn't a bad comic, but it was messy. It was very messy, which I have to be, I know I've said this a couple times here, but I have to be consistent with what I've been saying. A lot of John's stuff recently has been sloppy, overcrowded, kind of all over the place because he's trying to do so much that it doesn't really fit cleanly into one comic. That's what this book felt like to me. It felt like a lot of what John's has done recently, which is just not his best work. Like, you can see it. You can see the some of the typical John stuff that's in there, but it's just very rough around the edges. And that's kind of what I got from this comic, was there's some good stuff in it. There's some good ideas in it, but it's a messy comic.
I have to agree with you on that. And it kind of felt like it was just setting up the Young Justice Society.
But that's sort of been my problem, though, Drew, with a lot of what he's done recently, is that it doesn't ever feel like we're reading the book that he actually wants to write. We're always reading the book right before that. And, like, at some point, just write the damn book. You know what I, like, it's some superhero films are guilty of this, too, where it's like the film or the TV show is too busy setting up the next thing that they forget to be their own story. And John's in particular has been very guilty of this recently. And I think it's a large reason of why stuff has been so sloppy. I mean, think about the Three Jokers book, right? I mean, he set that storyline up at the end of the New 52, at the end of his Justice League run. He sets up and teases this idea that there are really three Jokers. And then that story doesn't happen for years. And eventually he tells it. And that book was okay. I have to admit, Drew, I'm surprised at how little I remember of that book, because it was pretty good. But even that book was supposed to be the book, right? It's set up. It's a setup for another story that God knows if he'll ever even write.
I know. If he was going to do a sequel to it, it should have been out already.
But that story's not done.
Yeah, I know. It's not done. He set it up to have another sequel to it, and we're still waiting.
Yeah, radio silence on that. He's the writer that got me into comics, and there is still stuff that he's done in recent years that I like. Like, I really liked Doomsday Clock. I very much enjoyed that because for one time, Drew, it was just, that was the story that he was writing. Like, at the end of the book, it does tease the future of the DC universe, as you would expect big time event comics to do. But for the most part, Doomsday Clock is just telling its story, right? But a lot of the other stuff that he's been doing is just not, it's just not focused. It's too busy of, like, I'm trying to set up this whole huge world, and I'm going to do this comic, and I'm going to do this comic, and I'm going to do this comic. But you got to know all of that, so I'm going to put it all in this one. So then, hey, I'm going to do this. In the meantime, you're like, dude, just tell the story. Like, what is going on with Corky, Drew? Like, that was so muddled and unclear, and they sort of hand wave it like, that's not even Corky's. That's not even really what Corky's going to be. He's upset at the end of the comic. What's going to happen with that? I don't know. Why spend any time on that? We got to commit time to teasing what the next five comics are going to be.
John's most focused book right now is the Justice Society book.
It is, because it's the one that's least concerned with telling you about tying into other stuff. Like, it is, right? It is still involved, but it is, that's why I've said it multiple times every time we talk about that comic. It's the one that I like that he's doing right now, because it's actually just telling its story. I've gotten a little bit frustrated with him recently, Drew, because I know I like his stuff. I know he can make some of the best superhero stories I've ever read. And it just feels like the dude's just all over the place and can't focus on one book. I don't know why. He's not writing that many of them. That's why I don't understand. He's not spread thin anymore, Drew. He's gotten booted out of all of the other stuff.
I don't know, dude. I just hope his future stuff is more focused.
I do too, but the pattern has only become more and more clear the more that we've read from him. This is more in line with what we've read than the JSA, to be honest with you, in the last, three or four years? We've gotten more books like this.
All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. Batman White Knight presents Generation Joker number 1. A week ago, at the Wayne Powers building, while Bruce and Harley talk about Jackie hears a voice coming from the computer. It is Jack. Jack has Jackie download his AI program onto a device called a Cobalt Vapor Drive. It enables her to project his hologram for her to see. A few minutes later, Bruce tells Bryce and Jackie that he is going to work for Agent Prince from the FBI in exchange for his freedom. The FBI have a job for him to do. Once that is completed, he'll be able to go home. A week later, Harley gets pizza delivery for dinner. Jackie is less than thrilled and is still angry that she is grounded for 3 more weeks, even though she helped save Gotham. Jackie barges into Bryce's room without knocking and just misses him talking to someone over the computer. Jackie teases that it is his secret girlfriend. Bryce states it's just a friend. Jackie tells Bryce that she has something that will blow his mind. Jackie shows Bryce the Cobalt Vapor Drive, and together they activate it. They are greeted by the hologram of their father. Jack tells the kids that he has a gift for them and takes them on an adventure. Sneaking through the house after Harley has fallen asleep at the kitchen table, Jack takes the kids to the Bat Garage, a place they are not allowed. They take one of the Batmobiles, one that is designed to blend in with normal cars. Jack takes the kids to the house he grew up in. Jack wants them to learn about his life when he wasn't the Joker. Harley goes to Jackie's room to have a talk with her, but discovers she is gone. Harley goes to Bryce's room and discovers he is gone too. Harley discovers the message that AI Jack left. Harley contacts Agent Prince to convince her to let Bruce help find the kids. Agent Prince states that that would be a conflict of interest. Agent Prince states that she and Agent Stewart will handle the case personally. Bruce tells Harley to go home and see things from his point of view. Harley figures out Bruce's secret message, get there before the FBI do. Harley gets back up and asks Red Hood and his sidekick to watch the hyenas and Ace. Harley goes out on a bat cycle and notices she is being followed. Harley discovers that Neo Joker is following her. Ivy also wonders why Neo Joker is there. Jack decides to take the kids to where he first met Harley, the Deuces Wild Nightclub. When they arrive there, Jack is surprised to learn that the place is now called Funny's Puppet Palace. When Jack and the kids go inside to explore, they are greeted by a puppet named Princess Penny. Princess Penny is being controlled by the ventriloquist daughter, whose father was killed by Azrael sent by the Joker. Since she cannot have revenge on a hologram, Joker's children will have to do. To be continued.
Drew, I feel like I've come off really negative on a lot of these reviews this week, which is surprising because a lot of these books I am more inclined to like, especially the White Knight universe. But this was really, I think, might be the first White Knight universe book that I did not like this. It was not good. Like, it was too silly in terms of concept. Like, oh, Joker's back again. The hologram that we thought went away, not went away. And now you can just see it. He's basically just a physical character. And I already thought that was pretty silly in the actual White Knight book. And it felt even sillier in this one, where it was like, look, if you just want Jack to be back, like, just can we just put him in a Lazarus pit and be done with it? Like, this is just getting dumb. And then the sloppiness with Bruce joining the Justice, or what, you know, effectively the Justice League. This was not good. This was the really, again, this was the first white, like, I still like the White Knight universe, Drew, and so, like, I didn't hate it because I still like these characters and I still like the world that it's set in, but this was poorly written.
You do realize this wasn't written by Sean Murphy?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That was very clear. But to be fair, though, Drew, it's piggybacking off of some ideas that he did write. And he did sign off on this book. This felt like it. I have this underlying feeling, Drew, that the White Knight universe might be jumping the shark. I kind of got that feeling with the Batman Beyond story. And this is continuing in that direction.
Me, I thought it was an okay story. Reading about the kids wasn't something I was really interested in. But I thought the story was okay. And one thing I did not like was the reintroduction of Neo Joker. I thought we were done with her. I didn't really care for her coming back.
There's too many characters involved in this story. It's way too involved. I know it's probably what it's trying to do is whatever the next Sean Murphy book is probably not soon after the end of the third book, right? And so this book is probably trying to do some legwork to set up certain status quo that Sean Murphy wants for his book, I would assume, right? And I feel like it felt like that showed in this book, Drew. It felt like there were certain things that were happening, not because it made sense for the story, but because they needed to.
Yeah, that makes sense. I didn't have as negative a take on it as you did. I thought it was just okay, so.
Again, I thought the third book for The White Knight was the silliest of the three in terms of concept. And I still liked it, but it did not land as well as the first two. And this book, when you take away the writer, but you keep some of the silliness from the last book, it just didn't land with me. There were scenes that I just thought were poorly written. Jack's whole thing where he's like, no, I have to show you this nightclub because that's the thing that's going to save my daughter. What? Drew, how does that make sense?
It doesn't. I was trying to figure out what Jack was doing by taking him to his house, taking him to, because that didn't make any sense to me either, what he was up to.
I don't know if it's possible that the angle the writer is going for is that he's not, doesn't have the skills as a dad because he's not had the practice to do it, right? Like, these kids grew up and he's dead and he's just a machine. So he doesn't have the experience, so that he's like, you know, out of his element. But it's still that, even that still feels at odds with a character that this universe's version is shown to be exceptionally intelligent, right? Like, very, very smart. And he's, I would argue, an idiot in this story. I don't know. It really didn't work for me. I want to be clear. I didn't hate it because there's a lot of pre-existing goodwill towards the story and the world. And I still am curious what's going to happen because, again, I like these characters. I like this world. But it was the first time I finished one of these, because we've had a couple other tie-in books in this world. It was the first time I finished a White Knight Universe comic. And I was like, ooh, I didn't really like that. it was notable to me, Drew, because even some of the other tie-ins I haven't loved as much. I never had that reaction.
Now, I got a question for you. They introduced Red Hood and his sidekick to watch the animals, but did you get the feeling that that was just an introduction to show that they're going to be helping out with the story later on?
Maybe. I don't know, man. The book is so overcrowded. I have no idea. I mean, why is Poison Ivy in this?
Yeah, I don't know that either. I noticed that was one panel, too.
It was poorly handled, but also Harley's quest feels extremely overwrought for what is the Joker taking his kids effectively on a field trip. Now, we know, the readers know that field trip has gone poorly, but Harley wouldn't know that. Like, Harley is treating this like this is a life or death. She must find them or the fate of Gotham is at stake, right? Like, she goes to HQ, she gets equipment, she goes and recruits a team. Like, this is overblown, to put it lightly, Drew.
Well, the way we saw her talking with Agent Prince was like it was the Joker that kidnapped her kids, not Jack.
But we know that that's not true. She knows that that's not true.
I'm just telling you what the feeling, what it felt like. The book was doing was like the Joker took the kids. That's why she was such in a panic about it.
I agree with you, Drew. That is absolutely how the story portrayed it, but that's illogical. That doesn't make sense. Jack even left a recording to tell her what he was doing. So it's not even like he just ambushed and took them out of the blue with no, you know what I mean? Like, her reaction makes no sense. This is just why this book did not land for me. It just didn't, the story was very poorly written and just did not, it was the first time I finished the White Knight book and I was like, oh.
All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. Green Lantern number 1. A hooded man with pink skin and yellow eyes is sitting in the corner of a bar in Coast City. On the television screen, Green Lantern Hal Jordan has saved some miners trapped in a cave-in. Carol Ferris is on the phone when she sees the same news story about the return of Green Lantern. Carol tries to sneak out of her office, but Hal Jordan is waiting for her in front of the building. Carol tells Hal no and that she has a boyfriend. Hal states he's looking for a job. The next day, Jordan shows off in front of the current pilots at Ferris Air and even calls Carol Queen of the Zamorons. When he crashes the drone he is flying, Carol is furious. A month earlier, Hal Jordan is sitting on top of his brother's old trailer, drinking a soda and listening to the radio. The Guardians of Oa have disappeared, and in their absence, the United Planets have seized control of the Green Lantern Corps. The United Planets have declared Sector 2814 an unsafe liability to the universe and have reassigned the Earth Lanterns to other sectors. Hal Jordan quits in protest, returning to Earth to start a new life. The top-of-the-hour news report catches Hal's attention when he learns that an armored man is shooting green lasers downtown. When Hal arrives downtown, it is chaos. The armed man is shooting lasers at people, claiming to be the Steel Fury. Hal rams his truck into the villain and then proceeds to fight him with a tire iron. Hal realizes that the armor the villain is wearing is Manhunter armor. Hal tells the villain to take it off quickly because it's dangerous. Steel Fury attacks Hal with a blast from his armor. Steel Fury is surprised that Hal hasn't become a pile of ash. Hal responds by telling Steel Fury that the armor was made a long time ago by some annoying blue aliens. Its power source is manipulated by willpower. There isn't anyone on Earth that has more willpower than him, the Green Lantern. We also had a backup story in this issue called The Rise of the Revenant Queen Part 1. John Stewart returns home and tells his mother he is staying this time. John's mother knows the truth. Someone will need him to be their hero and he'll leave again. And that is okay. Another universe, another time. The Green Lanterns are under attack. If the watchfire is extinguished, then every ring in the universe will go dark. Gardner recharges his ring on the eternal watchfire and recites the oath. I am the lantern in the dark, the torch that batters back the night. Let evil cower in the light of all who wear the lantern's mark. The Revenant Queen has come for John Stewart, the one who slew her son. To be continued.
Wow, Drew. Wow, what a breath of fresh air. I can't remember the last time we got it felt like a true Green Lantern comic. Like, I liked the Morrison stuff, but it was weird, right? Like, it was weird. This was good. This was really good. I liked both stories. I mean, I'm biased. Hal is my favorite character, so obviously I preferred the Hal Jordan part of the comic. I really, really liked the Hal Jordan story. But I liked the John Stewart story too, Drew. I liked John not being a god. A little more relatable. I know that might shock you, but I found him more relatable as a character.
But is he not a god in this? I thought he was still a god. He just wasn't using his abilities at the moment.
I don't know. At least they were portraying him as that. He might be, Drew, but we didn't get that in this story.
I got to tell you, I like this issue a lot, too. It was fun.
It was fun. It felt like a Green Lantern comic, Drew. Like I said, like the Morrison stuff was good, but it was Grant Morrison doing Green Lantern, right? This is the first time I feel like I've read a Green Lantern comic and felt like I was actually reading a Green Lantern comic and not some writer trying to do something clever with how can we make the Green Lanterns not be Green Lanterns. How can we deconstruct every single thing about them, take away everything that they are, and turn them into gun-wielding space pirates? It's just like, what if we just did the Green Lantern Corps? Like, what if we just had a guy with a ring and he went and saved people with it? What a wild concept.
It felt like the writer was trying to get away from the space stuff by quarantining the sector. But I wonder if they're going to explore that more later on, after we have Hal on Earth for a while. It's very intriguing, the mystery of why the Guardians have disappeared. Yeah. So I don't know if he's planning on exploring that or not, but I find that intriguing.
You know it'll return to space at some point, because even during Rebirth, John started with Hal pretty grounded on Earth too, right? It was, I think, maybe the second volume where Hal really started to go into space. So I'm sure that he will, but I don't mind us staying grounded for several issues and really just staying on Earth, getting Earth-based Green Lantern stories, because I'd like to see that, Drew. It's been a while. Even if we do go back into space, if it just is normal on-patrol Green Lantern stories, that would be really cool and not, oh, I'm in space, but my Green Lantern ring doesn't work, and so the very reason that you're interested in this character isn't going to be a thing. The best Green Lantern story that we had before this was the Far Sector, which was really good, and she wasn't even technically actually a Green Lantern, right? She was sort of a counterfeit one. That was really good, though, Drew. That was the only other, I felt like, true Green Lantern story that we got, and she wasn't even really supposed to be a Green Lantern in that.
I'm very curious what Sinestro is up to. Is he just hiding on Earth for now, or you would think that Sinestro would be taking advantage of the Guardians being gone.
The thing that I'm going to be really interested to see with this book, Drew, is what the hell Sinestro's status quo is, because we've been a little bit all over the map with where he's at power-wise. He's fluctuated pretty greatly since the end of Johns' run. Like, at the end of Johns' run, he's sort of at the peak of his powers as a Yellow Lantern, and that continues, because I've mentioned this on the podcast before, he had his own series for 20 plus issues after that, and it was, you got like peak Yellow Lantern Sinestro, and then we had the weird where we got rid of the Yellow Lantern costume, we went back to old school Sinestro, and he had that weird power during the Justice League run. You remember that?
Yeah, unfortunately.
I know. So I don't know. I know with this sort of relaunch, they're trying to get back to the roots of characters, and you felt that, I thought, really clearly with Hal's story. John Stewart's story did feel like a reset button. I mean, even if he is still a god in that, Drew, they really, that was not present in the story, right? It felt like they were bringing him back down quite a bit. It felt like to me. My question is going to be, going back to our roots, how far back are Sinestro's roots? Because I maintain that the best version of Sinestro is the Yellow Lantern Sinestro.
I agree with you there.
He was never as good. He's always been Hal's nemesis. And he's been in there since the 50s. Like, I've literally written a thesis on the guy. But I've read a lot of comics that feature Sinestro in it. And I'm telling you, he was never as good of a villain or just a character with depth and meaning as he was when John started writing him. I hope, obviously he'll have a yellow ring, right? That we know that much, but I hope it's the Yellow Lantern costume. I know that that's a silly cosmetic thing, but it makes a difference because that's the era that character actually became a three-dimensional character.
I also really like the Emerald Dawn stories that Sinestro was in too.
I do too. Emerald Dawn 2, where you get the sort of modern version of his downfall, spanning on his 2-page origin from his original appearance, is good. But even in that, Drew, it's not the same level of depth that you would eventually get with John's.
I know, but Emerald Dawn 2 holds a special place for me.
Oh, it's a good book. Hey, it's in my thesis too, man. I like that book. I'm not going to criticize that. It was a huge step forward for, again, adding depth to his character. But I maintain that we didn't get a fully fledged, because even in that, Drew, once he slips, he goes off the rails and becomes pretty black and white bad in that book. It's a good book. I'm not criticizing the book, but like, I find that character wanting in terms of depth compared to what he would become.
That's true. Johns' run's probably the best version of Sinestro we've seen.
Well, I want to give some credit because some other writers during that era also did a really good job. Colin Bunn was the writer, I think, for all of the Sinestro book, I believe, if not the majority of it. And he did a pretty good job with the character, too. So it was mostly Johns, but there were some other writers that I want to give some credit. Like, Sinestro during that era was really good. My hope is that that's the one that we get. I really don't want to see the purple triangle costume again, man. It it's hard to take that. One of the things that was good about the costume change is it's easier to take him seriously when his costume matches the vibe of what the other cores are, right? When he's wearing that silly purple triangle costume, he looks like a silly Silver Age villain. I've gotten into the weeds of this a lot. That the redesign of his character went a long way Ethan Van Sciver was the artist who originally came up with the costume, although he still gave the very enlarged forehead. And then there were some other artists that started to shrink that. Ivan Reis, who we just recently got treated to a book with his art again. I thought he was most responsible for really shrinking the forehead down into more human-like proportions. I felt like that the art went a long way towards his transformation as a character, Drew, because when you had the really big alien head combined with the silly costume, like, how threatening can he really be, right? Like, the writing can only go so far. And to be fair, the writing wasn't usually giving him a ton of depth, Emerald Dawn 2 being an exception, because that was a very good book. But you combine the artistic change for that character with the costume change and the increased depth in the writing, you got a much, much better version of Sinestro. And clearly Scott Snyder did not agree with us, right? Because he got rid of the yellow costume during that weird Justice League run. So I don't know. I'm very curious to see, Drew, but I'm very, very hopeful based on this first issue. This was really good. This was an unbelievable breath of fresh air.
Agreed. All right, well, that wraps up our comic book talks for this week. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll finish up The Flash.
People keep asking, are we back? Yeah, I guess we're back.
Back to talk about cigars, movies, TV shows, and any other nerdy topics here on the Cigar Nerds Podcast. Check us out on CigarNerdPodcast.com and ESONetwork.com. And we have a YouTube channel at Cigar Nerd Podcast, where we do cigar reviews, live versions of the show, and any other dumb thing we think to record.
Tune in to The Con Guy Show. Con, as in Comic-Con. We are Hollywood filmmakers and superfans who cover all the news of the con universe, including the films, the TV shows, the streaming series, the experiences, and the events that fuel your fandom. If you'd find it at Comic-Con, then you'll find it here. Now in our seventh year, The Con Guy Show is a proud member of the ESO Network.
And we're back. Let's talk The Flash, Season 9, Episode 13, A New World, Part 4. The Flash has returned from 2049 after learning Eddie Thawne is the new avatar of the Negative Speed Force. Eddie Thawne gathers a team of evil speedsters to kill The Flash, Reverse Flash, Zoom, Godspeed, and Savitar. Iris is in labor at the Central City Hospital. Barry shows up and Iris tells him the doctor says the baby will be coming in about an hour. Eddie Thawne shows up at the hospital with flowers for Iris. He says his name is Cobalt Blue and he is not here to fight, but to offer his congratulations. Barry and Eddie end up fighting anyways when Eddie tells him he is going to end the Flash and his bloodline forever. When Eddie gets the upper hand on the Flash, Team Flash shows up to help him. Virtue, Keone, Chilblain, and Barry's daughter Nora from the future. Eddie reveals his own team of evil speedsters. Team Flash battles against the evil speedsters. Nora gets stabbed through the stomach by Savitar, but she managed to vibrate her cells so she wasn't harmed. Nora takes out Savitar. Godspeed makes copies of himself and tries to attack Virtue. Virtue stops him by using her telekinetic powers. Reverse Flash shows up at Star Labs and tries to kill Chuck with red lightning. Allegra shows up and stops Thawne. Zoom tries to zap Keone and Chilblain with negative force lightning, but Keone just holds up her hand and absorbs it. Keone shoots the lightning back at Zoom, taking him out. Cobalt Blue takes hostages and jitters. Eddie states he will spare the hostages if Flash surrenders and lets Eddie kill him. Jay Garrick shows up and absorbs all of Cobalt Blue's negative speed energy. The other evil speedsters disappear as Eddie reabsorbs their speed energy and then teleports in a flash of red lightning. Keone tells the Flash the only way to build a better world is with coexistence. all things living together, not in conflict, but in mutual trust. Keown sends Barry into the negative speed force. Barry and Eddie battle as Barry tries to convince Eddie that his connection to the negative speed force is going to kill him. When Eddie realizes he's become the very thing he swore to stop, he rips the blue gem from his chest. Eddie destroys the blue gem. Barry and Eddie shake hands, and then Barry is returned to the hospital just in time for the birth of Nora. Mark tells Chester he has black hole powers, and that's why he survived Thawne's lightning. One of the Wells shows up and tells Keown that it is time for her to ascend. Baby Nora is born. Keown says her goodbyes to Team Flash. When Keown ascends, Caitlin is returned. 1 week later, during another Team Flash party, Joe proposes to Cecile. When baby Nora starts crying, Barry tells her the story of how he chose new speedsters to help. Avery Cho, Max Mercury, and Jess Chambers. The episode ends with Flash running.
The show's over.
Yay!
What a...
Now it's time for Team Earth Station DCU to have a party.
Oh, God. Thank God it's over. I got the distinct impression that a lot of the cast members felt the same way, Drew, because the effort that was given in several scenes was reflective of that.
They tried to make this episode feel like it was epic, but it wasn't.
To really boil it down, it wasn't because the writers are bad. They are not good at creating quality television. I don't know how to put it any simpler than that. They have thoroughly demonstrated this, Drew. It's just, there were so many things that were just not good in this episode, and we're just like, I don't even know how they thought it was going to be a good idea. Cecile can fly now? Oh, when, Drew? It's so clear there are certain characters that they love, and they'll do anything that they want and can do for that character because they love that character. But with no concern for, you know, logic. Drew, they brought back the big speedsters, right? Like the biggest villains of the show, right? The who's who. Now, I don't want to argue in terms of like importance, but I did think that it was odd that the Red Death was not in that group, not because she was important, to be clear, but what was the commonality of that group, Drew? They were negative speed force users that were all speedsters. She was literally just on the show, Drew. How is she not on that list?
I don't know. And the other thing that's funny is most of those speedsters are from back when the show was a lot better before the show.
Yeah, well, yeah. But anyway, so it's the biggest villains, the villains that, I mean, yes, it's a TV show, and so obviously they're not taken down until the end, but regardless of the literal reason, it took everything for them to take down those characters, right? Like, it took a whole season for the team to be able to build up and figure out a way to stop these guys, and every single one of them goes down like a chump to an individual member of the team without any interference or help from Barry himself. If Barry was not in the episode, literally nothing changes plot-wise. Cobalt Blue defeats himself, right?
Yep.
Changes that instead of the weird handshake that made no... Where did that come from? Where all of a sudden they're like, no, actually, we're the light and dark side of the force, and we have to balance each other out. Okay, whatever. But even taking that out, right, ultimately... Cobalt Blue is going to overcharge himself and kill himself if Barry doesn't intervene, right? So he effectively defeats himself without Barry's involvement. So if you take the Flash out of the series finale of the Flash, I just want to be super clear on this. If the Flash is not present in the final episode of his own damn show, the plot doesn't change. What outcome changes, Drew?
Nothing, because he didn't really do anything in this.
That's wild to me. I was talking to Aaron too. Like, what's crazy to me, Drew, is this season, there were some just brazen lack of care in terms of budget and taking the time to make scenes make sense, like the baby shower that was five people, but then the other party this episode, there is like an actual number of people that would make sense for a party. But then they're not willing to pay other people to be in an episode, so they're trying to not have characters. And then they clearly go out of their way to pay to bring back the actors that play Zoom, that play Godspeed. And you know what I mean? Like, they bring those actors back for them to do 5 minutes of screen time? Is this the show run by a dartboard? It's just wild to me, Drew. Some of the decisions that they made just don't make sense from even just like a logistics standpoint. Why bother? If that's all you want to do with Zoom, why bother bringing him back? Why bother bringing the actual character back? Just put an extra in the costume with the mask on.
I had to laugh when Keown gets attacked. She just, it reminded me of Yoda from Revenge of the Sith.
Oh, add that one too. Yeah.
Yeah. When she just absorbs the power, then shoots it back. I'm like, that's basically from Star Wars.
Well, we already have the lightsabers, the lightning lightsabers. They brought that back too.
Oh, yeah, that's true. They did, didn't they?
A stupid touch that we brought back. Man, Drew, it was just so, it was so bad. And then Keown, I feel, Drew, I want to get your opinion on this. I know I've mentioned this a couple times that they keep saying that she's a goddess, but I've been like, I think they mean like the goddess. And I felt like that kind of got confirmed maybe this episode.
Yeah, I mean, she ascended or whatever. And then she brings back Caitlyn.
I didn't get the impression that she was a goddess. I really felt like the show was saying it was the goddess, which is that's an interesting thing to do. I don't even mean that religiously. I mean, literally, like, that's how much they jumped the shark with some of these characters, Drew, that the writer's room was like, what if we made one of the characters actual god of the universe? And did it with a straight face.
Yeah, whatever.
You know what I mean? But that's, yeah. Like, that's where the writer's room got to a point where they were like, yeah, this is a really good idea. This is in no way ridiculous and over the top.
Well, yeah, because she brings Caitlyn back from the dead, so.
The problem I have with, it's fine, bringing Caitlyn back is fine. It's a nice, happy ending. And, of course, they're not going to kill any, the show doesn't have the balls to actually kill anybody off. But, like, why not just bring everybody back? Like, if you're going to bring Caitlyn back, bring Frost back, too. Why not? The show's over. Bring back Barry's parents. Why not? The show's over. Like, why are we stopping there? You know what I mean? I just, like, if you're gonna be like, yeah, well, she's God, so she's gonna bring back Caitlyn on her way out the door, then, like, why not everybody?
I was actually surprised they didn't bring Frost back. I was expecting to see
it. Why not bring Oliver back? Like, let's just bring it, like, everybody that ever died in the entire Arrowverse, let's just bring them all back, because death means nothing on the show. You know what I mean? That's sort of my problem with that creatively. When you start to do that, Drew, is like, why even stop? If that's what you're going to do, why even stop there? Like, if you're not going to even make it make sense, then just bring in everybody back.
All right. Let's just be happy it's over.
Thank God. Thank God the show is over. Oh, my gosh. It just got so bad. And it's wild to me, Drew. I was thinking about it. Because this was the cap on the Arrowverse at long last as a whole is over. And I feel like every single show fell victim to what we first saw on Arrow, which I don't know if it's just is it unavoidable on shows like long running shows that have long seasons? The main character was not the main character by the end of this series. We saw it on Arrow. Oliver absolutely fell out of the spotlight. It happened on Supergirl, on this show, Batgirl. The focus, obviously, that was a little bit more because of the cast change and all of that. Black Lightning was not really about Black Lightning. You know what I mean, Drew? Like, I don't know. Is that an inherent problem with doing 22 episode seasons for a long time span that eventually you start focusing on other characters because you've run out of ideas?
That's the thing, though. They shouldn't have run out of ideas.
It happened to every single one of the shows, though. Now, I don't know how much of that is because they're hiring from the same writers pool, and so they're getting the same crappy writers, to be frank. I mean, maybe that's part of it. I mean, the other commonality, too, Drew, is the characters inevitably that stole the spotlight were generally tended to be show-created characters because they kind of had the freedom to do whatever they wanted with those characters. I don't know. That's the thing. I'd be curious to know, like, I don't know how much longer Superman and Lois is going to have, if we're in the last season or not. But, like, if that gets a couple more seasons, does that change? You know what I mean? Like, is this just an inevitable thing that would happen to any superhero show over the long run? I don't know, man. But it happened to every single one of the Arrowverse shows became a victim of this, where the titular character, the character that the show is supposed to be about, was not about that. It was just, like, the Flash was not... I don't see how anybody could watch this season and think that the Flash was the main character of the show.
No, he wasn't the main character of the show. And some of the time, he was totally off the board. The Flash felt more like a side character to me this season.
Yeah. I mean, they did that on Arrow, but at least it made more sense with Arrow because he was dead, right? Like, halfway through, the character died. And so the second half of the season is not really on the show much. And it's like, well, that makes sense. His character's dead. You know what I mean? But, like, that Flash didn't have that excuse. They gave Flash the happiest possible ending that they could. I mean, he literally hugged it out with the villain at the end. So, I don't know, man. I don't know. Is that... I'd be curious to get our listeners' opinion on this, too. Is this just inevitable? Like, is this what is going to happen no matter what? Or is this just inevitable because it's on the CW? And that's the level of writing that you're going to get on the CW. I don't know.
I think it's a CW problem myself, but... And to answer your earlier question, I do think Superman and Lois is going to get canceled. I don't think they're going to announce it till it's over. One of the reasons why I think it's going to get canceled is because it's an expensive show. Not that it's not popular. I think it's because they're not going to want to spend the money on it. So I'll be pleasantly surprised if it gets renewed.
Oh, I'd be very, very surprised, but... Like we've said, there's the certainty of that show being canceled has been less clear than I would have expected. Going back to this, though, Drew, I mean, this was just unsurprisingly, given the quality of this season, the past couple seasons, just an awful, awful finale, a fitting cap to what the show became. Very frustrating. I thought there was a chance that there would be some moments that were still nice because they were bringing some old characters back, and somehow it just made it worse.
Yeah, I agree with you. All right, well, that wraps up our show for this week. Do you have a shout-out, Cletus?
So I wanted to save this until they actually put him in costume and gave him the Cobalt Blue name. It did in the silliest way. This is where you really felt the absence of Cisco, because I felt like the show got away with naming the characters their comic characters because Cisco would do it. In this one, you just had Eddie is just like, oh, I'm Cobalt Blue now. Why? Obviously because that's what he is in the comics, but that felt very silly in the show. Anyway, the character Cobalt Blue, they call him that because that is who he is in the comics. His name is actually Malcolm Thawn, and arguably, Drew, in many ways, I think is a fitting villain for the final season of the show, because what a silly, silly character. Did you read him when you were reading comics? Because he was a 90s guy, a late 90s guy.
I don't remember reading Cobalt Blue.
So he first appeared in 1997, written, shockingly, Drew, by Mark Waid. I shouldn't say shockingly because that was Waid's era of Flash, but it is... Let me read you. He is the long-lost twin of Barry Allen. When Barry's mom was giving birth in a hospital, or a small-town hospital, the doctor was drunk and misdelivered the Thawne's family's baby, and it died. And Barry's mom gave birth to twins. And the doctor thought, well, the best way to even this out, because nobody else knows right now, is I'm just going to give one of the twins to the Thawnes. It'll be fine. And so they're raised separately, and eventually Thawn realizes that he's not actually a Thawn, and he figures out that he's actually Barry's brother realizes that Barry has become the Flash and like takes it on himself to reclaim the life that he should have had and becomes Cobalt Blue. What an absurd character, a very 90s character, which is a little surprising from Wade, as I felt like a lot of his stuff was less 90s than other writers. God, what a silly character, and what a fitting character to be the final villain of the show.
Yeah, I don't know that story, so I was collecting comics in 97, I can guarantee that. I know Flash was on and off for me, so I have a feeling I wasn't collecting. I don't know that story, so I probably wasn't collecting it at that time. But I'm curious to check back through my issues just to make sure.
He first appeared in Speed Force number 1, which came out in 97.
Okay. I could tell you I don't have Speed Force. I don't have a title called the Speed Force. If I was collecting it, it would have been in the regular Flash title.
I feel like that's probably where he first popped up, and then probably popped into Wally, because Wally would have been the Flash at that point. Popped into the main book with Wally.
But and I can tell you, Wally
from what
was...
I've been reading, he didn't stick around very long, because, to be frank, he's a stupid idea for a character.
Now, Wally was the Flash when I was collecting the Flash comics, so...
I am honestly disappointed that they didn't make Thawne to be Eddie to be also Barry's long-lost brother, too. Be like, oh, actually.
That might have made it a little more interesting.
The show didn't take the opportunity to out-stupid the character, because they've done that at every turn possible. It's wild that they didn't this one time.
It might have made the story a little more interesting.
But couldn't have made it worse.
No, but the problem was they would have had to focus on Barry more, and we couldn't have that now.
We can't have that. Barry, God forbid Barry be in his own show.
All right, and for my shout-out, I'm going to shout-out about our new website. Yes, we have a new website. It's earthstationdcu.com, and you can go there and sign up for our new weekly newsletter that now the week before the show comes out, you'll be able to see what comics we're going to be reviewing, as we'll have them listed in our newsletter. So you can read up on them before the show from our newsletter, if you don't want to get it from me announcing it at the end of every episode. So, yeah, go and check out our website. I think it's pretty cool. So, and I think our newsletter is going to be pretty cool. All right, if you'd like to comment on anything we've talked about tonight, you can reach us at our feedback line, 317-455-8411. Leave us a message. Never know, we may play the message up on the show. Or you can email us at earthstationdcu@gmail.com. All right, Cletus, coming up next week, we've got Black Adam, Batman, The Brave and the Bold, Batman, Superman, World's Finest, Batgirls, Catwoman, Superman, Titans number 1, The Flash, Wonder Woman, and of course, The Flash movie, which I'm very excited about seeing. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
In brightest day,
in blackest night, no evil shall escape my sight. Let those who worship evil's might beware my power, Green Lantern's light.
I'm off.
Where are you going?
I've got to go punch a clock with my other boss.
I can see where this is going to be a long commute.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.